The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Katherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
Struggle for the GOP soul. How Romney's front-running campaign for the nomination is dividing his party over social issues, financial inequity, and capitalism itself.
Inside the Tea Party, a new book looks more closely at the demographics, dynamics, and demands of the nation's newest political machinery.
The next big things and little ones. Our recap of this year's Consumer Electronics Show, to which actual consumers are not invited.
Luck and Circumstance. Director Michael Lindsay Hogg's new memoir recalls the Beatles on film, Brideshead on TV, and boy genius Orson Welles in a daddy role.
Sex and the Iron Lady. Author Gail Sheehy spotlights the softer side of tough British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher as her new biopic opens nationwide.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for Your Ears Only, a production of Gatewave Incorporated, the nonprofit radio reading service for those with disabilities. For Your Ears Only, for the week of January 15th and the South Carolina primary, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Katherine Herzog.
Those of us who believe in free markets, and those of us who believe that, in fact, the whole goal of investment is entrepreneurship and job creation, would find it pretty hard to justify rich people figuring out clever legal ways to loot a company.
I will suggest they're just vultures.
It's a very envy-oriented, attack-oriented approach, and I think it'll fail.
GOP presidential contenders Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry last week ratcheted up attacks on the sometimes dog-eat-dog fundamentals of capitalism itself, at least as practiced by frontrunner Mitt Romney in his Bain Capital years. And even far more staunch conservatives like Rush Limbaugh jumped to Romney's defense, warning Republicans not to play a Democrat's game.
But Newt's heavy TV campaign did help him up to second place in South Carolina, while Ron Paul's second place finish in New Hampshire boosted him to third there. Beyond the money, media, and organizations in play, the GOP nominating race is also a real battle for the soul and direction of the party, divided over social, economic, and foreign policy priorities. Boston Globe Washington Bureau Chief Christopher Rowland wrote about that aspect of the race last week, and he's on the line now to say more for Your Ears Only. Welcome back to the program.
Morning.
Beyond the personalities and the power of money and organization, how do you define the key GOP factions seeking to define their party?
Well, one of the things that was really interesting about the Iowa caucus results were how starkly they rendered the divisions within the Republican Party between social conservatives represented by Rick Santorum, the fiscal conservatives represented by Ron Paul, and then the business and foreign policy establishment represented by Mitt Romney. These three factions of the Republican Party are vying for really to define how the party is going to look going forward into 2012.
Many say the GOP needs another Ronald Reagan, though you note he'd be a moderate by today's standards. Was the real key Reagan's personality, charisma, movie star status, and who in the GOP field today comes closest on that score?
Well, Mitt Romney really wants to be sort of the overarching umbrella candidate. You know, you can see it in his various appeals to fiscal conservatism and also in his discussion of patriotism. He recites, America the Beautiful at his campaign appearances. But what the thing about Reagan was that he was so good at articulating that optimism, that sense of mission about America's standing in the world in a way that was really compelling for everyday voters. I think that was one of the secrets to his success. Mitt Romney does not quite have that. He doesn't quite stir the passions of people the way Ronald Reagan was able to. And that really will be a challenge for him as he tries to unite these warring factions.
Newt Gingrich does at least come close in that arena, but he has so much negative baggage that it seems to counteract it.
He does. I think that Newt, definitely there's a really staunch group of conservatives who like Newt a lot. They remember the contract with America. They remember his strong fiscal message of restraint and cutting spending. And yet, after he left the speakership, he was definitely an inside the Beltway operator. You know, Mitt Romney has really exploited that well through his super PAC and reminding voters of the negatives of Newt Gingrich, and that's really what's been holding him down.
It's clear that Ron Paul has the resources and determination to go on to the end, but to what degree do you see South Carolina forcing out others with less money and support? Perry, John Huntsman, even Santorum, who dropped 30 points on some South Carolina polling last week.
It really seems that anyone who doesn't perform well in South Carolina is going to have to really reevaluate what their goals are heading into Florida. Florida is such an expensive state where you have to advertise on multiple media markets. You need to have a strong organization. I think Santorum, Perry, and Huntsman, unless they come in, really have a surprising result in South Carolina, could be in serious jeopardy and may have to drop out.
There's a Tea Party convention in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, this weekend, but so far those folks have seemed almost as divided as the larger party. Any late indications of what may develop in terms of an endorsement, the strongest conservative or best against Obama?
Well, it's really true. They are so highly fractured. Even the gentleman who's organizing that Myrtle Beach convention, he's endorsed personally Newt Gingrich, but there's a number of other people in the South Carolina Tea Party coalition who have endorsed Santorum or Perry. So at the grassroots level, the Tea Party really has no consensus on whom they want to back. And then at the national level, you've got national groups like Freedom Works, Tea Party Patriots, that have really sat on the sidelines and are not endorsing as of yet. The interesting thing is that you can see in the polls that a lot of Tea Party people, there's sort of a difference between Tea Party activists and Tea Party supporters. Tea Party supporters are definitely ready in many respects to get behind Mitt Romney if they have to.
What was your reaction to the Limbaugh reaction to Newt's attack on Romney's venture capitalism?
Well, I thought it was really interesting. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, calling basically for order within. Don't go after your own family members. I mean, this is a free market. Mitt Romney's business is capitalism at work. And he was basically calling Gingrich a foul as a referee, for the Republicans. I think a lot of people see this as hurting Romney and, by previewing attacks that are going to come from Obama in the general election, it doesn't do the potential frontrunner here any good, that's for sure.
That same line of attack was taken successfully against Romney by Ted Kennedy in their long-ago Massachusetts Senate race. Do today's tougher economic times make it even more dangerous for Romney? Is he now better able to counter it?
It's really interesting because I think that it does make it tougher. I think a lot of people are hurting. They're unemployed. So, to be showing images on television of shuttered factories and doing interviews and showing depicting people in ads who have lost their jobs is a message that really resonates negatively for Mitt Romney. And, Gingrich as well as Obama in the general election will try to do this because it goes right at Romney's perceived strength. So it's trying to change his strength, which is his claim to be able, American capitalists who can create jobs, and trying to turn it into a negative, showing that he was actually destroying jobs. And in that respect, it could be potentially devastating. Mitt Romney really needs to come up with a better way of answering this attack.
How does the new Republican Party rule on proportional distribution of delegates affect how long the race will go on and therefore how important campaign war chests and super PACs will be?
I think it's sort of uncharted territory. Nobody quite knows exactly how this could play out, but certainly Ron Paul has already signaled that he wants to stay in for the duration and amass a number of delegates in individual states moving forward. To what end? It allows him to generate and create a pile of delegates that he could either use, at the convention or to use as leverage to get, the party to pay more attention to him. He's gaining power within the party. I think it also allows candidates to make an argument to their donors, like, hey, look, I'm amassing some delegates, even small numbers. Give me money. I could make a surge. If Mitt Romney stumbles, we could have an alternative.
What are your sources saying about how willing rank-and-file Republicans will be to rally around a candidate who is not their first choice? I read that one poll showing Romney was the most acceptable fallback for a majority of those who don't already support him.
That's absolutely true. I think that when you ask people who their second choice is, Mitt Romney is always at the top of the list. And one of the startling polls that I saw coming out of New Hampshire was that even among Tea Party supporters, so 88% of Tea Party supporters said that if their favorite was not nominated, that they would get behind Mitt Romney. So I think that, in that respect, I think Mitt Romney definitely has a potential to begin to unify the party if he is the ultimate nominee.
Christopher Rowland is Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe.
Quote from the news, too much of a maze. That was President Obama on complaints about the federal bureaucracy as he challenged Congress to restore presidential authority to merge and eliminate government departments to streamline the executive branch, a major campaign year ploy.
Next, Inside the Tea Party, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Their surface fleet would be at the bottom of the ocean, but they could score a lucky hit. That was Michael Connell, director of the Iranian Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analysis, predicting the outcome if Iran ignores U.S. warnings not to close the Strait of Hormuz, as European allies and Middle East oil sources support tightening sanctions on oil exports from Iran to halt its nuclear program. Tensions were further heightened last week by the assassination of yet another Iranian nuclear scientist, prompting supporters of the regime to call for retaliation in kind against Israel. Now this.
I believe that we will make an endorsement probably before South Carolina. We've discussed it, and we probably are going to get involved. I said it last week, and I believe it, that it is a game changer, and it's going to carry on into Florida.
Whether that prediction by Amy Kramer of the Tea Party Express on Breitbart TV is accurate was not clear as this weekend began, and other Tea Party activists convened in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. But overall, it's obvious that the Tea Party phenomenon has changed the face of current politics. Its energy, passion, and organizing skill helped Republicans take back the House of Representatives, setting the stage for subsequent stalemate on key tax and spending issues and the practical functioning of Congress itself, which may backfire on the Tea Party and the candidates it backs this fall.
A new view of this important political process comes from a just-published book titled The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism from Oxford University Press. The main author is our past guest, Theda Scotchpole, a Harvard professor of government and sociology, and she joins us again now for Your Ears Only. Welcome back to our program.
Well, it's nice to be here.
First, tell us about the research methods you used.
We used all kinds of evidence. We looked at the national picture of various kinds of organizations that have pushed the Tea Party label, and we looked at the role of the media, Fox News and CNN. We pulled together everything from national surveys, but I guess what was most unique about what we did was that we wanted to get to know grassroots Tea Party protesters more directly than you can by just dropping in on a few events. So we had in-depth interviews with several dozen of them in New England, Arizona, and Virginia, and we visited Tea Party meetings in all of those regions as well to observe what was going on.
And what did you learn about the demographics of the Tea Party as it has developed?
Pulling together what we know from surveys as well as what we learned in our in our observations and interviews, Tea Partiers are older white people, mostly all over, virtually all over 45 and many of them 60 and above. They are longtime conservatives. So, I mean, I think early on people were imagining they were in the middle of the road, but really that's not true. These are people who vote for Republicans against Democrats when it comes to that, and maybe they adhere to movements to the right of the Republican Party the rest of the time, but they are not middle-of-the-roaders.
In the early days of town hall meetings on health care reform, there were jokes about seniors demanding government keep hands off their Medicare, as if that wasn't one of the largest government programs of all. But you found a surprising number of Tea Partiers are receiving benefits from that, other government programs, which in a way subsidize their anti-government activism.
Well, that's right. Since these are older people, they are either collecting Social Security checks on Medicare or on military veterans programs, or about to be. And one of the things we got to in our open-ended interviews was how do they think about these kinds of government programs compared to others? And what we learned is, first of all, they know they're government programs and they know they're expensive, although as people who listen to Fox News, they probably don't know there's a major part of the federal budget, along with defense spending. But they think that these are benefits that go to deserving Americans who've worked hard all their lives, certainly including them and their neighbors. They're critical of government spending for people they think of as freeloaders.
And to the degree that the Tea Party makes illegal immigration a top priority, you see less racism than that same opposition to undeserved government benefits.
Yeah, I mean, we heard echoes of longstanding conservative stereotypes about lazy blacks on welfare, but the concern that is most intensely held by Tea Partiers in all regions of the country is a concern about illegal immigration, and not so much that illegal immigrants are taking American jobs, but that they are collecting educational and health benefits that are paid for by taxes on law-abiding Americans. They're very concerned about. And they're concerned about young people collecting things like Pell Grants to go to college. They consider those to be virtually welfare.
How do you see the current controversy over Mitt Romney's years at Bain Capital and whether that style of venture or vulture capitalism produces profits the Tea Party sees as really deserved?
You know, a lot of people on the left think that Tea Partiers are critical of Wall Street, but we didn't really find that grassroots Tea Partiers were critical of businesses of any kind. They're worried about corrupt connections between business and government, so they don't like government bailouts of Wall Street. But I would not expect many hardcore Tea Partiers to resonate very much with the criticism of Romney that he made his money as a venture capitalist.
On the issue of government spending and benefits, you found fault lines between the Tea Party's grassroots and some of its major funders and media champions. Talk about that.
Well, that's right. Grassroots Tea Partiers, like most Americans, really do support Social Security and Medicare, whereas the elite advocacy groups like Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works that are pushing the Tea Party and trying to leverage the grassroots, a top priority for them is to privatize those major social entitlement programs. Now, it doesn't come to an overt clash very much, but these are definitely somewhat different policy objectives.
You also found a cultural component of fear of changing the face of America and the traditional American ways of life, whether by immigrants or by their own children and grandchildren.
You know, Obama is the perfect storm in the minds of Tea Partiers, not so much because of his black skin, but because he's got a foreign father in an era of heightened immigration that concerns Tea Partiers. And I think some of them were quite alarmed by the fact that millions of young people supported his campaign. He symbolizes a more cosmopolitan, a more socially tolerant America, and that is a scary prospect to many of the elderly Tea Partiers who say over and over again they're losing their country.
We're witnessing in the current campaign conflicts among Tea Party factions over which Republican candidate to support and even whether the standard should be conservative credentials or best chance to beat Obama. Tea Partiers, quote, want to win, you write, but you also say that they see victory in the defeat of a Senate candidate like Christine O'Donnell in Delaware because her nomination itself worried GOP moderates. So what's your best guess on how the party, the Tea Party, will unite or divide on a presidential nominee?
Well, it doesn't surprise us that grassroots Tea Partiers were not able to find one candidate to vote for other than Romney. We interviewed people in the spring of 2011, and we found that they were all unenthusiastic about Romney, mainly because they see him as inauthentic, as a sort of the ultimate shapeshifter. But at the same time, they didn't agree on any alternative. And, you know, we heard people say very pragmatic things. For example, that Sarah Palin wasn't the right candidate. They might like her, but she couldn't win. And elite ideologues and grassroots voters alike want to defeat Obama.
Theda Scotchpole is a professor of government and sociology at Harvard and co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, new from Oxford University Press.
Another quote from the news, have a great day, buddy. That was one of several U.S. Marines in a video of them urinating on Taliban corpses. The incident drew immediate condemnation by Afghan and Taliban leaders and apologies from the U.S., concerned it would undermine Washington's latest attempt to launch talks with Taliban representatives to end the war.
Coming up, the next big and little things in consumer electronics for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, President of the United States of South Carolina. That's the invented office for which Comedy Central host Stephen Colbert said he was setting up an exploratory committee, turning over control of his super PAC to fellow mock news anchor Jon Stewart. One recent poll of likely Republican voters showed 5% support for Colbert in South Carolina versus only 4% for real candidate John Huntsman. Now this.
We wanted to deliver the most innovative platform available and make it as user-friendly as possible. And today, I'm thrilled to announce that the best of Intel's computing is now coming to smartphones.
Intel CEO Paul Otellini unveiled the latest in ultrabook and smartphone technologies at the 2012 Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas last week. And it was just one of the high-profile high-tech introductions at the annual event, from which ordinary consumers, ironically, are mostly excluded. So here now with a recap of the latest gizmos and larger trends for your ears only is John Phillips, editor of the Gadget Lab blog at Wired.com. Welcome to our show.
Thanks very much.
It seems Intel is a driving force behind the new breed of ultrabooks. What are they, and how do they compare with what we understand as laptops and tablets?
Right. So Intel actually has trademarked the term ultrabook, and what they're trying to do is support their initiative to push more high-performance, low-power draw processors into the marketplace. So these CPUs are going into ultrabooks, and essentially they're very thin notebooks, very light, and they have batteries that last quite a long time for their performance that they deliver. And another key feature is that rather than using traditional hard drives, they use solid-state memory. And so unlike a traditional PC that might take 30 seconds to boot up, you open up your ultrabook, hit the power button, and boom, you're up and running very quickly. And so it's a very friendly consumer experience, and in large part, it's a response to the MacBook Air, which is so successful for Apple.
And whose versions of the ultrabook were most impressive?
There were so many introduced at the show, and it's a gigantic spectacle, CES. So it's hard to hit every one. But one in particular, the HP Envy Spectre. This is coming out in early February, and it's covered from head to toe in Gorilla Glass, which is the same substance that protects smartphone screens. It's a very durable substance, and it's beautiful to the touch. It also has really good speakers, and it has what's called a near-field communications chip inside of it. So if you have a smartphone that also has one of these chips, an NFC chip, you could actually swap data very quickly between your ultrabook and your smartphone.
And what does the introduction of the ultrabook mean for the formerly frenzied tablet arena?
You know, tablets, the iPad 2 rules that arena. And last year, a lot of upstarts tried to weasel their way in to sort of poor success. So this year, the PC industry is giving it another shot. And what we found is that the manufacturers are going for much smaller sizes. So the Kindle Fire has been a huge success for Amazon, and it's inexpensive. It's a 7-inch tablet. Now, Steve Jobs said that he thought that the only tablet size that consumers would really accept would be a 10-inch tablet like the iPad. But Amazon has proven out that smaller tablets can sell if they're inexpensive enough. So at CES this year, there were a couple of notable releases that basically showed much smaller sizes at much lower prices. So the big one that everyone's talking about comes from a company called Asus. And it has one of those names that's hard to follow, but it's the MIMO 370T. And it's going to be running the fastest processor available right now, and also the best version of Android, which is Google's mobile operating system, and that which has the nickname Ice Cream Sandwich. And this is a 7-inch tablet. It's going to be selling for $250. So for $50 more than the Kindle Fire, you're going to get much better specs.
Another trend you predicted was connectedness in our cars, with ever more Wi-Fi communication, information, and entertainment. Just as Washington warns about safety threats, even from no-hands cell phone use, how does Detroit bridge that divide?
Right. And, you know, I love driving cars, and I love my mobile technology, and I would agree with the government that these can be very distracting devices. And so Detroit and the European automakers and the Japanese automakers are actually delivering technologies that can bridge that gap and make driving on the road much safer. So rather than fumbling with your phone to text a message or even check an email, you can use voice activation that directly links to technology in the dashboard to say, read my email. You could even make restaurant reservations or update your Facebook status with the applications that are being deployed directly in car dashboards. And so where before these were very high-end options that you might find in only the highest level versions of each automaker's brands. Now they're dribbling down to the lower end too, and so it's sort of no longer a luxury item, but a checkoff item, if you will, to have this kind of connectivity inside your car.
You also found health and fitness gadgets with connectivity, including a scale by a company called Fitbit. Tell us more about that.
Right, and so this is very cool, and this is one of this is a trend that's emerging in big force at CES, but we've been seeing it for the past year. So Fitbit has made for the last couple of years a little tiny, it's essentially the size of a large paper fastener. You would put it in your pocket, and it can record how many steps you take, how many stairs you climb, how many miles you've walked, hiked, or run. And so they're well known for that, and it's a very successful product. And it syncs up to your web browser, and all this data of your activity, you could look at it, you know, at a glance. And so at CES, they introduced the Fitbit Aria Wi-Fi scale. So you step on the scale, and in a completely secure connection to the cloud, it will upload your how much you weigh that day. And you could also go to a web browser or an app and see your body weight change over time. Another interesting thing about this scale is that up to 8 different family members can use the same scale. The scale will automatically recognize who's stepping on the device.
John Phillips is editor of the Gadget Lab blog at Wired.com.
Quote from the news, "I didn't even know phones came with alarms." That was the unnamed possessor of a new iPhone that accidentally went off during a New York Philharmonic concert, eventually stopping the performance and prompting his later apology. Quote, "It shows how important people still feel live performance is," said conductor Alan Gilbert.
Next, Luck and Circumstance, a memoir of theater, TV, and paternity. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane." That was Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein quoting Martin Luther King Jr. in advance of MLK Day holiday and promising, quote, "expanded and improved Medicare for all." Now this.
Don't smoke.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
Here, at the age of 39, I began to be old.
Question. What do Orson Welles' single most famous word in movies, the last public performance of The Beatles, and the opening lines of British TV's Brideshead Revisited have in common? Answer, Michael Lindsay Hogg. The veteran actor, director, created the Beatles' rooftop concert to end his film about them, Let It Be. He was also the initial director of Brideshead, as well as Whose Life Is It Anyway? And Agnes of God on Broadway. And Welles was the great good friend of his beautiful actress mother, Geraldine Fitzgerald, and, as long rumored, Michael's secret father.
Contending with and confirming those rumors is a leitmotif of Lindsay Hogg's recent memoir, Luck and Circumstance, A Coming of Age in Hollywood, New York, and Points Beyond, from Alfred Knopf. But the book is full of intriguing insights and encounters with generations of other entertainment VIPs, from Bogart and Bardot to those Beatles, the easier-to-work-with Rolling Stones, AIDS playwright Larry Kramer, Laurence Olivier, Geraldine Page, Jeremy Irons, and Amanda Plummer, to name just a few. And to talk about what he learned from and about them all and about himself, for your ears only, we're pleased to have Sir Michael Lindsay Hogg on the line now. Welcome to our show.
David, thank you. And Catherine, great introduction.
You were smitten by your mother's profession even before you knew of the rumors about your natural father and his preeminent place in it. Talk about what hooked you and when.
What hooked me, David, was I wasn't really good for anything in the normal world, I don't think. I grew up as a very out-of-it kid. I couldn't read till I was 9. I was fat. I was bullied. I was squashed. I was deeply, deeply unhappy. And then one day when I was 14, my mother asked me if I'd like to come down and watch her rehearse an off-Broadway play. And I did. I went down there. And the actors were very nice to me. They made me feel included. They made me feel there was a world that I maybe could do something in. I didn't know what it was going to be. The director of that off-Broadway show was the very young Sidney Lumet. And he gave me my first job for $1 a day on the weekend, being on the book in case the actors forgot their lines. And immediately I felt there was a kind of home. And I've never really left it. I've never earned a penny in my life which has not been in the theater or the movies or television or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to rock and roll on TV and those early music videos?
I got lucky. And then when I was only 24 years old, I was directing a live television rock and roll show in England called Ready, Steady, Go. And it was during the great rock and roll boom. It was 1965. And the regular bands on the show were the Rolling Stones and the Who and the Kinks and visiting Americans, Roy Orbison, the Supremes, etc. And I was good. I directed the show well. The bands liked the look. They liked the way they were shot and everything like that. And as a result of that, I was asked to do the earliest videos. The Beatles used to watch the show, and they asked me to do Paperback Writer and Rain, and later Hey Jude and Revolution, and the Rolling Stones asked me to do Jumping Jack Flash. And it was really as a result of this show and the early friendships I made with the bands. But the interesting thing is we were all more or less the same age. I mean, I'm 3 years older than Jagger. I'm the same age as John Lennon would have been. So we knew what was going on in the world at that time.
Talk about the difference between working with what many fans considered the sweet Beatles versus those defiantly nasty Rolling Stones.
Well, the Beatles weren't actually all that sweet. They were tough. They were made sweet by Brian Epstein and those cute little suits they wore when they first started out and their little bumped up Fab Four haircuts. But they were tough. They came from Liverpool, as you know, which was a tough blue-collar port city in the north of England. They didn't come from a privileged background at all. They had to, listen, they played all-nighters in Hamburg when they were 17 or 18 years old, drink drugs, rock and roll. They learned the hard way. The Rolling Stones, I've always thought the difference slightly was that the Rolling Stones came from the big metropolis, London, or near enough to it. They'd had a different background. They were slightly more middle class than the Beatles had been. And Mick Jagger, as you know, went to the London School of Economics for 2 years. And they all were... had interest beyond rock and roll as well as rock and roll. Charlie Watts has always been interested in clothes, the Rolling Stones drummer. He says he supports all the tailors in the West End. And Mick Jagger is incredibly well-read and was at the age of 21. Not to say the Beatles aren't, but I think it was the Stones came from the great big city and had that sophistication and didn't come up with their fists, and the Beatles had much more come up with their fists.
I'm old-fashioned, and I don't mind it, as Mercer and Kern once wrote, so I was equally fascinated by your first and second-hand encounters with stars of an earlier age, like Humphrey Bogart, anxious about his career in general, and one particularly chaotic picture in particular.
Yeah, my mother had been at Warner Brothers at the same time as Humphrey Bogart and the other actors, and my mother was, she and he had been in Dark Victory together with Betty Davis and Ronald Reagan. That's a pretty good cast. And he was worried about his career. He thought he'd never really make it. He was pushing 40, and he thought his time was over. And then he was doing a movie after that, and they were on the lot, and they were having lunch in the commissary together, my mother and Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart. And Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart were saying the movie they were shooting at the time, they didn't understand it, it didn't have a good ending, and they were sure it would end up in the dustbin. And, of course, the movie was Casablanca.
Orson Welles gave you some early experience in the theater, but then drifted in and out of your life, only occasionally, almost accidentally. Did you come to think he was embarrassed or just didn't want to overshadow or handicap your career with any hint of favoritism or nepotism?
Whatever the connection between Orson and my mother was, and I think the book gives pretty good evidence of what it probably was, he was astoundingly irresponsible in pretty much all of his intimate connections, especially with the children. He was really in and out of their lives. Sometimes he would say, I'll see you next week, and then the child wouldn't hear from him for a year. But I think as far as personal relationships were concerned, he was not good at it.
And in the end, do you think all those rumors helped or hurt your career?
Well, they've been around for such a long time. I don't know. They were kind of like, you know, wasps on a summer day. You know, they're just around to annoy you or not.
Actor-director Michael Lindsay Hogg's memoir is Luck and Circumstance from Knopf. Next, The Sexy Side of an Iron Lady for Your Ears Only.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alperin with this quote from the news. The mission was a farce and the observers have been fooled. That was Anwar Abdel-Malik, who resigned from the Arab League observer mission to Syria as President Bashar al-Assad declared he would continue to battle against the continuing opposition. Now this.
Welcome to the madhouse.
One simply has to maximize your appeal, make you look and sound like the leader that you could be.
With all due respect, when one has been to war...
With all due respect, sir, I have done battle every single day of my life.
The marvelous Meryl Streep plays the often fierce former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher on screen in The Iron Lady, which opened wide around the country last week with a good shot at this weekend's Golden Globe Awards and the upcoming Oscars. Much of it deals with Thatcher's rise to power from a working-class background, breaking into the male-dominated Tory party and the House of Commons, transforming herself from a mere politician to a tough world leader, though eventually forced from office.
But journalist and author Gail Sheehy, writing for the DailyBeast.com last week, turned a spotlight on the softer, dare we say, sexier side of the Iron Lady, who knew when to show a little leg if it seemed beneficial. To talk about that now, for Your Ears Only, we're pleased to be joined again by Gail Sheehy. Last hear about her book, Passages in Caregiving. Welcome back to our show.
Love being with you, David.
10 years into her position as prime minister, you recall, Thatcher underwent a sort of fashion makeover. Give us a before and after snapshot, if you will, how Thatcher presented herself early in her political career, how her wardrobe changed.
Well, early she was very, very stiff, buttoned up to the neck, lots of big, ugly hats that she was ridiculed for, very mannish blue suits and long hemlines, sensible shoes. When she had been in power for 6-7 years, as she told me in an interview, well, now she believed she was right, right all the time. And so she had this late-blooming sexual charisma, which most Americans would find laughable. But it was very much on evidence around her chaps, as she would call them, or her star boys. And she began showing more of her legs in the House of Commons, with for her backbencher sitting behind her, sometimes rubbing one calf with the other, and wearing off-black stockings. She had her wardrobe makers, Aqua Scutum, revamp her entire wardrobe. She had her skirts hiked up. She had her necklines lowered. And she wore high heels and sometimes strappy heels. And to the people who were around her, she began using that sexual side to manipulate the men around her.
Was there a noticeable public reaction to a female world leader dressing this way back then?
Well, she actually got some points for it because she had been so ridiculed for the ridiculous hats and the very uptight matronly clothes, which she had had to do as a first female who had come from, you know, northern England with a grocer's daughter's accent and into that cauldron of sexism and classism that was England at that time. So she was very, very careful, developed with the help of an elocution teacher a very plummy accent, sometimes more plummy than the Queen.
Besides looking more appealing to the men around her, she also liked the men around her to be pretty good looking. Talk about her relation with those chaps.
Oh, well, she all her guys looked something like 1930s American matinee idols. Her favorite would have been Clark Gable, somebody who was a little bit, naughty. And she used to sit with her men up until 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, drinking whiskey, working very hard at 10 Downing. Her husband would be asleep. She only needed four hours of sleep herself. She also had a chap who was young, very handsome, much better than her own son, and she would have him travel with her. And the funniest story that was told me was by one of her ambassadors. She would like to meet him at the plane when he returned to Heathrow in her Daimler limousine, where she could push the buttons and they would both suddenly be reclining, almost, as if they were in bed. And they would get very cozy and they would just share state secrets and gossip.
Thatcher also experimented with some holistic medical therapies as part of this middle age rejuvenation. Talk about the Hindu practitioner who added a jolt, literally, to Thatcher's makeover and the routine that was actually involved.
Well, she actually would ask her to strip and step up on a stepladder and get into an electrical bath. Madam was a practitioner of ancient Ayurvedic arts, and she had baffle plates in this bath, and she could control them with a little button at the end and put the amps up to 0.3 and create waves of electrical energy over a period of an hour that were meant to recharge the nervous system.
You actually tried it yourself. How did it go?
Well, I was scared to death. I was standing at the top of this thinking, what do I have to do to pin down a story? And the madam, shamed me. She said, I have the most high-powered women in the world in my tub, prime ministers and ambassadors, kings, princes, and little bitty emirs. You have nothing to fear. And she did say that she had Thatcher, Pamela Harriman, and Mikhail Gorbachev, who was sent by Thatcher.
Besides the pricey fee she charged, she also came away with what you thought was some real insight into Thatcher the woman.
Yes, she said, Mrs. Thatcher's a very, very feminine woman. She said, like me, we're very strong, but we're not hard. We know what we think, where we want to go, but when away from the public eye at home, the man is boss. And interestingly, the Iron Woman film doesn't show Dennis Thatcher as boss. He was very, very happy to have Margaret have center stage. He was never competitive with her. But he was kind of the clown. He was the relaxation therapist. He would put on a, pink Swami's hat and make her laugh. And she fussed over him and, cared for him and made sure he wore his galoshes. And they were very, 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 very close. And you see in the film that she was actually quite dependent on him.
Gail Sheehy is the author of Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence from Morrow. Her most recent piece on Miss Thatcher is online at thedailybeast.com.
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. There's nothing more depressing than being pale in the winter. That was Jersey Shore TV star Snooki Polizzi launching a month-long Tanuary promotional campaign for her Super Tan indoor skin darkening products.
For Your Ears Only is online at YouTube, iTunes, and PodcastBunker.com. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donation. Please email davidearsonly@gmail.com to learn how.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan. With intern Kaimana Larson, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern, acknowledging support from loyal listener Joe Diamond, the nonprofit Gateway of Radio Reading Service, the century-old Carnegie Corporation of New York, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation, plus the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago.
This week we dig back further to repeat our celebration of a 10-year tribute to the late, great Frank Sinatra from our August 29, 2010 broadcast, hosted by Melissa Exelberth and me.
Oh, but you're lovely, with your smile so warm, and your cheek so soft.
I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
Cabaret performer Eric Comstock doesn't pretend to sing like Frank Sinatra, but he carries on the tradition and the legacy, most notably with two other singers in a hit show 10 years ago called Our Sinatra. And this week they bring it back to where it began, the fabled Oak Room of Manhattan's Algonquin Hotel, for an anniversary encore.
To talk about the show, Sinatra, and his legacy to pop music and culture to this day, for your ears only, Eric Comstock joins us now. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you, David. It's great to be with you.
What led you to create the show?
The idea was that Christopher Gines, Hillary Cole, and I felt that our generation of saloon singers or nightclub singers or cabaret singers owed a great debt to Sinatra and felt that perhaps some of the other singers that we knew in New York were not as aware of the influence of Sinatra. So that was our goal, really, to do an unpretentious, evening of the really high-class songs that Sinatra introduced and helped to turn into songbook classics. And that's how it began, and of course it became a hit engagement at the Algonquin, followed by a very long off-Broadway run, and it's toured the country, and this is the first time we are reuniting in New York, so it will be a great joy.
How many songs connected to Sinatra do you actually sing?
If you count the mother of medleys at the end, which is, I think, 35, all by itself, I would say there are 58 or 60.
And how did you choose from the hundreds and hundreds that Sinatra sang over the years?
Well, he actually recorded there 1,500 official recordings, not to mention air checks. That wonderful, The Way You Look Tonight, you played, I bet that's from a radio broadcast, because I'm not sure he recorded it in that tempo.
It's from one of the V-discs that he did for the soldiers during World War II.
Terrific. Excellent. Good detectiving. How do we choose? Well, we chose in large part because they reflect our taste. The title of the show, after all, is Our Sinatra. So we do not sing My Way. We do not sing Strangers in the Night. We sing the true mother load of American popular standards, many of which were kind of selected and codified by Sinatra. Before Sinatra, singers, even big star singers, did not, as a rule, record and perform in concert songs that were 20 years old. It was always the new thing and looking for a new hit. And Sinatra had such good taste at his best that he made a lot of great songs, and I'll just list five or six. Here's That Rainy Day was going nowhere fast. I've Got You Under My Skin. I Guess I'll Hang My Tears Out to Dry. These were not becoming standards, and Sinatra's belief in them and awareness of their craft made the difference.
And what do you see as the secret of Sinatra's appeal?
It's so vast, I cannot give you a 30-second answer remotely. There's a wonderful book by Pete Hamill called Why Sinatra Matters, and that goes into great detail. Even though it's a very slender volume, it's, I think, the interesting fact that Sinatra began as a Bobby Sox idol. No one really reacted to any pop star the way that girls reacted to Sinatra. Elvis and the Beatles came along later, but I think he was the first. So he began as the Deb's Delight with his fan base, primarily women, and then after a series of reversals in his career and humiliations and being dropped by Columbia Records, being dropped by MGM Studios, and of course being dropped by Ava Gardner, let's face it, he came back. He came roaring back as a different man and a different singer. And he became, he had a male fan base. Men didn't resent him, as they did during the war, for not being in the service, but they revered him, they envied him, and he just had a different, more masculine style, so that he appealed so across the board. And you could also get into the immigrant experience, the fact that he would not anglicize his name, though he was urged to do so. He was a proud Italian-American when a lot of folks were changing the names and taking off the vowels. And, of course, the fact that even though he worked stadiums more pretty much toward the last 20 years of his career anyway, he always managed to connect one-on-one because he was such a fine actor in song. He could make any room shrink to a nightclub, and he never turned his back. No matter where he worked, he never turned his back on the saloon song and sharing his pain with an audience, which is a very brave thing.
What does the success of your show say about his lasting appeal in our rap hip-hop era? Are you seeing younger people taking to it?
I think to know about him is to love him, and I just think people do if they're exposed to a more romantic, gentle kind of song and a way of presenting music. I see people loving to court to that sort of thing again. I can't understand folks. I don't know how people court these days. Perhaps they're not even courting, they're texting. But I think there was that punk manner of Sinatra also that does appeal across the generations. He wasn't Bing Crosby, a great artist, Bing Crosby. Bing Crosby was a very suburban, safe, you know, guy next door, and Sinatra was anything but. He was urban, he was ethnic, and tough. And, of course, he also managed to show a vulnerable side. That was another element of his brilliance, that he had two types. He could be both.
Sinatra Sings Again, from our August 29th, 2010 broadcast. And the R. Sinatra crew unites again this week, January 17th through the 21st, at Feinstein's Cabaret in New York's Lowe's Regency Hotel. In Chicago, a revised version of Twyla Tharp's blend of old Blue Eyes songs and creative choreography, Come Fly Away, is drawing some mixed reviews. The Chicago Tribune calls it an artful yet devil-may-care sensual romp, but the Sun-Times finds it over-the-top and hugely depressing. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, more from our Sinatra.
2, 3, 4. It seems we've stood and talked like this before. We looked at each other in the same way then. But I can't remember where or when.
The clothes you're wearing are the clothes you wore. But the smile you were smiling then. But I can't remember.
First time seem to be happening again,
and so it seems that we have met before and laughed before.
So it seems that we